Rev up your thrills this summer at Cedar Point on the all-new Top Thrill 2. Drive the sky on the world's tallest and fastest triple-launch vertical speedway. And it's your last chance to get more fun for less with our limited-time bundle for just $49.99. Get admission, parking, and all-day drinks for one low price. But you better hurry, because this limited-time bundle ends June 30th. Save now at cedarpoint.com.
Over the past four days this week, like in many other cities across the country, hundreds of New Yorkers reported for jury duty. And upon entering the courthouse in Lower Manhattan, these New Yorkers discovered that the defendant in the criminal case sitting before them was the former president, Donald Trump. When the prospective jurors were initially asked if they could be impartial during the trial of Donald Trump, many came forward and said they could not, point blank. Those people were dismissed and got to go home. The ones who said they could remain fair and impartial, they were then questioned further during what is called the voir dire process. At that point, more details emerged about who these New Yorkers are, what they do for fun, how they consume their news, and how they live their lives. Today, one potential juror elicited laughs when he said his hobby is, quote, trying to find a wife. It's not working, end quote. Another admitted to subscribing to the New York Times, quote, mostly for the crossword puzzle, end quote. While another says he cleans his local dog park twice a year as, quote, meditation. Several even admitted to having read at least a little bit of Trump's book, The Art of the Deal. None of those people ultimately made the jury. One of the unfortunate consequences of this part of the jury selection process is that many identifiable details about potential jurors were published by the press, putting the jury's ultimate anonymity at risk. Yesterday, one juror, originally juror number two, asked to be excused for this very reason. And the judge granted her request and ordered the media to be careful about revealing identifiable information. Another potential juror was dismissed today after telling the court she has, quote, really bad anxiety and people have found out where I am. The anxiety is completely understandable. For a criminal trial of this historic magnitude, there is a heightened level of intensity inside the courtroom and outside. Donald Trump, who has a history of riling up his followers, some of whom go on to commit violence, has been attacking the judicial process day in and day out, calling it corrupt and a witch hunt. Case in point, today, Trump posted a video on his social media site, Truth Social, that wrongfully attacked the jurors, all in an attempt to paint the process as rigged.
This is a Manhattan jury. It went 87% for Biden.
One of the jurors said, I don't believe I can be
fair and unbiased.
The deck is stacked against him.
Trump violated election laws. Okay. What laws?
Now, not often that our buddy Von Hilliard makes it into one of those ads, but you may have noticed it. My NBC colleague, Von Hilliard, in a video that Donald Trump posted. Now, what Vaughn was talking about was the former juror number two, the woman who asked to be removed from the trial because she felt that the exposure of her identity, which was described at length by the media, meant that she could no longer be fair. It wasn't a confession that she was biased against Trump. But defendant Donald Trump's project all along has been to distort the truth surrounding this trial, to attack the process, to undermine the judicial system. In yet another last-ditch effort this afternoon, Trump's lawyers tried to get an emergency stay from a New York State appeals court, arguing there was no possible way for Trump to get a fair trial in Manhattan. The response from the district attorney, Alvin Bragg's office, was simple. What the last week has shown is that the jury selection has worked. He continued, we have 18 ordinary New Yorkers who are ready to serve. It would be unfair to them and the public for this trial to be delayed further, end quote. The appeals court judge agreed and quickly rejected Trump's request. Right now, the good news is, amidst all the intensity and the ruckus, the judicial system so far has not bent to Trump's attacks. Despite what he says, the system is working for the former president just like it would for any other American. At the end of today, a full jury, a 12-member jury with six alternates, was seated. Donald Trump's peers, who may ultimately decide whether or not to convict him as a felon. Now, after the jury was selected, the focus turned to what Trump might say, not the lies he spews outside the courtroom, but rather what he might say under oath if he indeed chooses to take the stand. Trump has previously indicated that he plans to testify in this case, and today He's sticking to that story.
President Trump, are you going to testify?
Yes.
Now, whether he actually will or not, we shall see. Under New York law, if a criminal defendant wishes to testify in their own defense, they are granted what is known as a Sandoval notice, which ensures that the defendant is aware of the lines of questioning that the prosecution may ask. The purpose is to make sure the defendant is not caught off guard when testifying on the stand. Some of the things the Manhattan DA's office wants to cross-examine Trump about are the two civil trials that Trump recently lost, the E. Jean Carroll defamation trial and the New York fraud trial. Judge Merchant said today he would decide on Monday what questions will be permitted during Trump's potential testimony. Monday is also when opening statements and potentially the first witness testimony are set to begin. Joining me now, the aforementioned NBC News correspondent Vaughn Hilliard, who's been reporting on the trial, as well as MSNBC legal analyst Catherine Christian, who served as special assistant DA in the Manhattan District Attorney's Office. Good evening to both of you. Thank you for being with us. Vaughn, let's start with this Sandoval hearing, this idea that Donald Trump says he will testify in his own defense. He is entitled to know what the line of questioning is, and it's not a given that whatever the DA says he wants to ask is going to be asked. So now the DA, I guess, presents the judge with the lines of questioning, and the judge determines?
Right. This afternoon, the district attorney's office made the case to the judge that a series of other trial determinations, from E. Jean Carroll lawsuit to the civil fraud lawsuit, but also there was a couple years ago, Trump filed the lawsuit against Hillary Clinton and several other defendants, which he was punished with a $1 million fine for essentially a frivolous lawsuit. And they want to present to the jury each of these different trial determinations to question the credibility of Donald Trump. As the district attorney's office argued today to the judge, they said, look, the defense attorneys for Donald Trump are going to question our witnesses and their credibility, from Michael Cohen to Stormy Daniels. We should be able to build a body of evidence out beyond this case that shows and questions Donald Trump's veracity of the statements that he makes.
Catherine, let's talk a little bit about these jurors. We have 12 jurors and
can
six
alternates. Can I just make one correction?
Yeah.
Can I make one correction?
Yeah.
It is not to let the defendant know the line of questioning. It's to let the defendant know what prior bad acts they're going to ask him about. The other questions he's going to be surprised about. But anything about, you know, prior judgments or prior bad acts, he has to be made aware of that. Sorry.
Got it. So they do not have to disclose things that are not about his prior bad acts. They can
exactly.
Go with any line of questioning they want. But if they are going to talk about prior things that have happened to Donald Trump or that he has done, then he has to know about that.
Exactly.
Got it. Thank you for that clarification. Let's talk about 12 jurors, six alternates. That's the maximum number of alternates. Typically speaking, a case doesn't run out of jurors and alternates. But as the pressure continues to be on these jurors and or their identities become known, either because the media doesn't handle this well or for whatever reason, is there any concern that some full complement of jurors doesn't make it to the end of this trial?
Definitely. And that's why Judge Merchant chose the maximum allowed of alternates you're allowed in New York, unless it's a murder one case, six. You already had one yesterday come back and say, on second thought, she can't handle it. Now there's a weekend. So the hope is the 12 that are seated will still remain strong and say that they, yes, I can still be fair and impartial. But if they're not, there'll be six ready to fill in, of course. We hope the six alternates also will still want to be on the jury and can still remain fair and impartial. And, you know, the judge can and the court can do something about making the jurors feel more secure. I think in this case, which was done in Donald Trump's federal trial, the judge should, and it's going to cost money, but court officers should be protecting them when they go to lunch, maybe in an undisclosed location as a group. And they should be escorted home in groups. They all, because they have to, live in Manhattan. So we're not talking about a long commute. So you're not sequestering them. So mm-hmm. They're not staying in a hotel, but you're protecting them during the pendency of this trial.
What, in your opinion, how'd it go, the jury selection? I mean, we got it done inside of a week. Seemed to go with relative haste. Those people who were not going to be jurors were dismissed quickly. What was your sense of it? You were sitting there watching it.
Look, Donald Trump's opportunity had the opportunity to go and use their peremptory challenges to eliminate several potential jurors that they questioned. And so Donald Trump, over the course of the next 6-7 weeks, is going to become very familiar with the faces of those 12 jurors and 6 alternates that are in there here. But, you know, when it comes to Donald Trump in the courtroom, over the last year, he's become quite familiar with one, not only from the civil fraud trial, but we've got to go back to the E. Jean Carroll trial just in January of 2024. Right. There has been a jury that has heard testimony. Granted, it was 3 minutes of testimony from Donald Trump. And they did in January determined that $87 million penalty in the E. Jean Carroll defamation suit. So Donald Trump has had a New York jury before rule against him here. And now the question here is, over the course of these 6 to 7 weeks, with that intense pressure that are on these individuals. Of course, we heard them even during their vetting process, if you may, say several of them question, you know, look, I've heard from family and friends, even colleagues who question, am I a juror? And with such identifying, you know, from everything from a neighborhood to their jobs to whether they're married or not, undoubtedly over the weeks ahead, folks are going to become familiar with those closest to them of who these jurors are. Now, for Donald Trump, you know, it's out of his control. It's in the hands of his legal team unless he chooses to testify.
Catherine, let's talk about this business about Donald Trump testifying. He maintains he's going to. Is that good or bad for him? And do you think it'll happen?
I don't think it will happen. I mean, he has an absolute right to testify. And unfortunately for his attorneys, they have no control over him, which is another reason why he shouldn't testify. But if he does, I think it will be good for the prosecution case and bad for his case because he's out of control. And this judge will not let him sit there and pontificate. He will have to answer questions. And the judge could just shut him down if he's not following the rules. When I say shut him down, meaning you're off the stand, it's over. If he's not following the rules and he's not answering questions, why? Because there's a jury there. This is not like the civil fraud case where it was just a judge. There's a jury there, and this judge will not allow there to be prejudicial information getting to this jury.
Vaughn, talking about following the rules, there are already some questions about whether Donald Trump's been following the rules in terms of the things that he's been posting. But yesterday, the prosecution prosecution was supposed to tell the court who they're going to call to the stand on Monday. Yesterday, the defense asked for the first 3 witness names. The prosecution said they didn't trust Donald Trump not to tweet those names. So they said they will give the defense 1 name on Sunday. And, quote, if that should be tweeted, that's the last time we will provide that courtesy. Now, this seems to be a bit of back and forth between the Trump defense team and the prosecutor. Is the judge sounded in on this?
Yes. Judge Mershon, when Todd Blanche, Donald Trump's attorney, went to the judge looking for that request, and Todd Blanche said, well, I can affirm that my client, Donald Trump, is not going to post on social media about the names of these witnesses. And Judge Mershon said, I don't know if we can trust your representation on behalf of your client.
Right.
Essentially, a head nod saying, you may good faith be making that statement,
right?
But we have all seen Donald Trump operate, and we don't know if we can trust that. So what they have allowed is on Monday, the prosecution, they said out of respect and deference for the legal team, they will provide the name of the witness that will come forward on Monday. A court will be abbreviated for Passover on Monday. It'll only go till 2 p.m. Eastern. So we are expecting the initial questioning of this witness, but then the cross-examination will not begin until at least Tuesday.
How does that work? Practically, Catherine. I mean, at some point, the witnesses will be known. So what's the goal here? And what's the thing? What's the assurance that the court has to have from Donald Trump about what he will not do as it relates to witnesses? Because in theory, there will be a series of witnesses whom we will know about.
Well, there's a gag order, which, in my opinion, he's been violating. And there's a hearing on that on Tuesday. So typically, when you have a normal case, and you have a defendant who is not like Donald Trump, you give over the witness list to the defense and you say, and you announce in court, tomorrow we're going to call Mr. Jones, Ms. Smith, and if there's time, you know, Ms. Christian. So the defense will know. And you do that as a courtesy so they can prepare their cross-examination. But in this case, and the prosecutors are right to do this, you don't want to do that with this particular defendant because you don't want him, as they said, tweeting about them. and intimidating them before they take the stand. Because they, the same way we're concerned about jurors being afraid to come to court, same thing will happen with witnesses. They don't want that to happen to them. Because when Donald Trump tweets negatively about people, his followers, some of them, tend to attack those people.
It'll be an interesting few days to watch. Thank you to both of you. We appreciate it. Catherine Christian is an MSNBC legal analyst. Vaughn Hilliard is an NBC News correspondent. We appreciate your time tonight. All right, coming up, Iran's foreign minister says Israeli strikes inside his country last night were, quote, like toys that our children play with, end quote. We'll discuss the latest tensions in the region. But first, it looks like the House will finally pass a foreign aid bill to help Ukraine. But far-right members are furious. Will the Republican Speaker Mike Johnson survive the fallout? That's next.
Rev up your thrills this summer at Cedar Point on the all-new Top Thrill 2. Drive the sky on the world's tallest and fastest triple-launch vertical speedway. And it's your last chance to get more fun for less with our limited-time bundle for just $49.99. Get admission, parking, and all-day drinks for one low price. But you better hurry, because this limited-time bundle ends June 30th. Save now at cedarpoint.com.
When news breaks, go beyond the headlines with the new MSNBC app. Get real-time analysis from live blogs to in-depth essays, video highlights from your favorite shows and hosts, and the latest updates on the 2024 election. Go beyond the what to understand the why. Download the app now at msnbc.com/app.
After months of delay, it looks like the House will finally pass much-needed foreign aid for the embattled nation of Ukraine. Today, the House voted 316-94 to allow for separate votes on bills to fund Ukraine, Israel, and Taiwan. It now looks like the House will pass each of those aid bills tomorrow, or they'll certainly try to, but the drama in the House is far from over. Today, the far-right Arizona Congressman Paul Gosar announced that he would be joining his colleagues Marjorie Taylor Greene and Thomas Massie of Kentucky in supporting a measure to oust the Speaker Mike Johnson, which is a so-called motion to vacate. If all Democrats vote together against the Speaker, Mike Johnson can only afford to lose two Republican votes to save his seat. And Republican Congressman Mike Gallagher is expected to leave Congress sometime after this weekend's votes, after which the Speaker Johnson can only afford to lose a single vote. Despite that razor-thin margin, the Speaker is projecting confidence that he's going to stay in the job.
Are you worried about your job?
No, I don't worry. I just do my job.
Is it time to call MTG's bluff and just put the motion to vacate on the floor?
We'll see what happens. I'm going to do my job. I'm not deterred by threats. And we're going to do the right thing and let the chips fall where they may.
With three Republicans now seemingly committed to ousting Johnson, the Speaker will need help from Democrats in order to stay in his job. So will any of them help him? Today, the House Minority Leader Hakeem Jeffries kept reporters in suspense about what he and his caucus plan to do.
At the appropriate time, as House Democrats, we will have a conversation about how to deal with any hypothetical motion to vacate. Moscow, Marjorie Taylor Greene, Massie, and Gosar are quite a group. And I'm sure that will play some role in our conversation.
Joining us now, Congressman Jim Himes, Democrat of Connecticut and the ranking member on the House Intelligence Committee. Congressman, good to see you again. Thank you for being with us. What a several months this has been. Mike Johnson went from being a backbencher to somebody who's now privy to sensitive intelligence about our foreign adversaries. I don't know. Did that contribute to his change of heart on the need to pass this Ukraine aid bill? Because he was a holdout himself.
Yeah, I think it did. I really think it did. And look, I don't think I agree with Speaker Johnson on anything political. But I will say that he said 2 months ago, we're going to pass the budget. And we had a whole, you know, freak out over whether there could be a shutdown. He said we would pass 702 FISA, which we did last week in the House. And now I think we're going to pass UK and Israel as supplemental. And it has all gotten done. So again, I don't think I agree with a thing he thinks politically, but, you know, he appears to do what he says he's going to do. And he's gotten stuff done. And yes, of course, he's going to be threatened by, I love the way Hakeem put it, you know, quite a group, the absolute most fringy members of Congress.
So talk to me about the logic. And some of the logic is, I suppose, when the election comes around, Democrats can say the business of America needs to be done, and we supported the business of America being done. On the other hand, Mike Johnson was, has been, and continues to be an election denier, an ally of Donald Trump's. What's in it for Republicans to help him?
You mean Democrats?
What's in it for Democrats? Thank you.
Is for us to be. Yeah. And in fact, I think his problem is maybe more with Republicans than it is with Democrats. But the answer, Ali, is very, very clear, which is we demonstrated in the last Congress that we are the bipartisan party of getting stuff done. We got the bipartisan infrastructure law done after it was a joke for years and years. We got the Inflation Reduction Act, which, you know, capped insulin at $35 a month for diabetics. I could go on about this. You know, the PACT Act, which protected our veterans. We showed in the last Congress that almost everything we accomplished was bipartisan. And then in this Congress, imagine going into November and being able to say that the only reason in the last Congress anything got done, that a government shutdown was averted, that Ukraine aid was provided, et cetera, was because the Democrats were willing to work with a speaker who, just as you say, is ideologically everything that we do not believe in. But you asked a political question. What's in it for us is to demonstrate time and time again that we're about getting things done for the American people, not about partisan posturing or social media antics a la Marjorie Taylor Greene.
Is there an abiding fear? Do you think about or worry about or care that if Mike Johnson disappears, someone less palatable shows up in his job?
Well, what we know for sure, because we've seen this movie before, when Kevin McCarthy was defenestrated, what we know for sure is that that means a period of abject chaos. You know, it was 3 weeks in the case of Speaker McCarthy before Mike Johnson was finally voted in. And look, there is a tension. There is a tension here, right? I mean, it is not our job as Democrats to save Republicans from their manifest dysfunction. On the other hand, if you set aside our partisan interest, which I think we regularly do, we are about delivering. And so we delivered the rule today. More Democrats voted for a Republican rule. This is unheard of, Ali. More Democrats voted for a Republican rule than Republicans did. Mm-hmm. And I think that in the, tomorrow, we will be the margin of victory for aid to Ukraine, aid to Israel, and humanitarian aid for the people of Gaza.
Now, in order to do that, to save Mike Johnson and to get what you just said, the aid to Ukraine, aid to Taiwan, aid to Israel, do Democrats discuss now wanting more out of this deal? I mean, like they would if this were a minority government in a parliamentary situation. I mean, is this going to be on a piecemeal basis for these three bills, or is there going to be a larger discussion between Hakeem Jeffries and leadership and Mike Johnson's team to say this is what going forward looks like for us?
Yeah, I think that conversation is inevitable, because tomorrow I think we will pass all of these bills with a supermajority. And that's a whole other conversation. Imagine a majoritarian body in a democracy held up by three or four fringe members. And then when the vote actually happens on Ukraine or Israel, you have a massive majority in support. But to your question, yes, there's very little doubt in my mind that after these things pass, Marjorie Taylor Greene or Paul Gosar or one of those guys is going to call for a motion to vacate. Now, we won't have to deal with it tomorrow. We'll deal with it when we come back. But yes, that's the moment when we say, when presumably Speaker Johnson goes to Hakeem Jeffries and say, hey, look, you know, who knows what's going to happen? I could be replaced with somebody you can't work with. We could have weeks and weeks and weeks of dysfunction. Let's talk about what the Democrats do to protect my job. That'll be fascinating. And you labeled it exactly what it would be. It would be a sort of a coalition government, which, by the way, will be appalling to a lot of members of the majority. But guess what, guys? You had a majority and you screwed it up. So, you know, I think there's a conversation to be had there. Obviously, it will be had by Hakeem Jeffries. And, you know, look, I'm a pragmatist. So if that results in us getting more things done on the other side of this Ukraine vote, you know, that's something we should absolutely consider.
Thank you, sir, for your analysis and your time. We always appreciate it. Congressman Jim Himes of Connecticut is the House Intelligence Committee ranking member. Thank you, sir. We've got lots ahead this evening, including the apparent double standard that universities are applying to student protests and diversity of thought. The New York Times' Michelle Goldberg joins me later in the hour on that. First, Iran is responding to Israel's military strike inside the country overnight by denying that a strike happened at all. What that downplaying means for raised fears of a wider war in the region is next.
Rev up your thrills this summer at Cedar Point on the all-new Top Thrill 2. Drive the sky on the world's tallest and fastest triple-launch vertical speedway. And it's your last chance to get more fun for less with our limited-time bundle for just $49.99. Get admission, parking, and all-day drinks for one low price. But you better hurry, because this limited-time bundle ends June 30th. Save now at cedarpoint.com.
Hi, everyone. It's Katie Fang. Did you know my weekly show on MSNBC is now available as a podcast? With my decades of experience as a trial lawyer, you'll get an insider's perspective on all things legal. At a time when politics and the law are inextricably intertwined, my guests and I break down what's next and why it matters, both inside and outside the courtroom. Search for The Katie Fang Show wherever you're listening and follow.
Israeli forces carried out an overnight military strike inside Iran in what appears to be Israel's first response to Tehran's unprecedented drone and missile strike over Israeli territory last weekend. Iranian officials say the strike targeted a military airbase near the historic city of Isfahan, which is 200 miles south of Tehran, but they're also downplaying its significance. In a one-on-one interview with NBC's Tom Yamas today, Iran's foreign minister Hossein Amir Abdollahian said that the strikes were, quote, more like toys that our children play with, end quote, while a former Iranian diplomat dismissed it as fireworks. Now, according to U.S. military sources, Israel had notified the Biden administration through multiple channels shortly before the attack. But today, Secretary of State Antony Blinken made clear the U.S., quote, has not been involved in any offensive operations, end quote, and did not endorse the military action. This tit-for-tat attacks between Israel and Iran represent a level of escalation in a region that's already reeling from Israel's ravaging war in Gaza. Yet the restrained rhetoric coming from both parties today and the limited scope of the responses so far also suggests that neither side is willing or ready for an all-out war. Joining me now is Noga Tarnopolsky. She's a journalist who has spent decades covering Israel and Palestine. Noga, it is great to see you in real life. And it's important for our viewers to know we've been talking for a few years about this. This is not new. This is not a post-October 7th thing. And you are steeped in the difficulties, the domestic difficulties in Israel, the difficulties between Israel and its Palestinian neighbors, and of course, this issue with Iran, which has been Benjamin Netanyahu's cause celebre for a long time, right? His existence is based on the idea that Iran poses an existential threat to Israel.
That's right. And I think 30 years after he started on this line, Israel confronts Iranian weapons on almost all its borders, Gaza, Lebanon, Syria,
And Yemen, for that matter.
And Yemen, yep. You're absolutely right, via the Red Sea. And for the first time ever in the history of this entire conflict, which dates back to 1979, Iran dared to directly attack Israel with 350 drones and cruise missiles. And so, I mean,
Regardless of what happened, that's a massive attack.
Absolutely.
There are wars in which you don't, in all the time I've covered Russia, Ukraine, there's never been a day when there have been 350 projectiles that have gone into Ukraine.
It was absolutely a show of force for Iran, a successful show of force. They overflew Al-Aqsa, one of the holiest sites in Islam. There were interceptions over the Israeli parliament, the Knesset. This was absolutely a major attack and a major show that they can do it.
Right.
And I have to say that it's also a failure for Netanyahu, who has said for the past three decades that he's Mr. Security.
Right.
And he's the only guy who knows how to stand up to Iran. And here Israel is, you know, absolutely under a barrage from Iran.
So I've been reading some things this week in which the military establishment is getting increasingly frustrated with Netanyahu because there's a feeling that what is good for Netanyahu is not necessarily good for the safety and peace of Israelis.
That's right. And I want to point out, you and I have been talking about this now for more than a year, because when Netanyahu returned to power in January 2023, basically, and announced a takeover of the state institutions, a sort of judicial coup d'etat, the military was among the first bodies to warn him, this is going to harm the security
right.
of the state. And that was behind some of the major protests that dogged him until this war began.
But this is a thing we have seen time and time again around the world, particularly with strongmen type leaders who are otherwise in trouble, as Netanyahu is, because he is in the midst of a criminal prosecution. They not only do they want to hold on to power, but external attacks typically strengthen them. Attacks on the country typically strengthen them. Since last night, since last weekend, when I've been covering this, I've spoken to people who increasingly say that's not necessarily what's about to happen or what's happening right now in Israel.
That's right. Israel is the outlier in this respect. He was an unpopular prime minister just ahead of the war because of what we're talking about, and his popularity has crashed since. I think in part it is because he really sold himself to the Israeli people as their security god, their savior. Only I can do it. I could go through years of campaign slogans that show that. And I want to add another aspect, which is he also said he was Israel's Mr. Security in
right.
the respect that he was the chief diplomat.
Yeah.
And that has also crashed and burned. And Israel faces now a level of critique internationally that Israelis are really not accustomed to. So I think Israelis in general are seeing Netanyahu as flailing in this situation.
There's reporting from the Wall Street Journal that we've not been able to confirm that the United States is floating an idea that if Israel accepts a two-state solution, something that Benjamin Netanyahu has been not only been against, but has been elected on the basis from day one of standing against, if they were to accept that, the United States would arrange for Saudi Arabia to recognize Israel and normalize relations, which in theory would lead to other Arab neighbors doing so. Sounds like an interesting idea. Any possibility of it being true or getting any traction?
I think it's very likely true. I don't have 100% confirmation, but in Jerusalem, people are operating as if that were an option on the table. The issue is the United States doesn't control either what Saudi Arabia
Correct.
Does, what the Palestinians will do. And I doubt it's possible with Netanyahu, although it puts him in a terrible, terrible corner, which may be what the Biden administration
Right.
wants, to tie his hands, because he has promised Israelis that only he can bring peace with Saudi Arabia. And Saudi Arabia is the holdout. If you think of, let's say, a 60-year-old Israeli, the aspiration of that person's entire life has been to be accepted in the region. Israel faced a boycott for most of its initial decades and wars from neighboring countries. So to be accepted by this behemoth would be huge. And for Netanyahu to turn that down
right.
would be very
That will be his legacy if that happens. Noga, thank you. We will continue this conversation in the morning.
Wonderful.
You're
to
in
see
town,
you.
So we're gonna make sure we get our best use out of you. Great to see you, my friend. Noga Tarnopolsky is a journalist who has had decades covering the Israeli-Palestinian situation and the global situation. Thank you for making time for us. All right, coming up, the university president's decision to have more than 100 student protesters arrested is sparking a wider conversation about the state of free speech on school campuses here in America. We'll have that story next. This is Asna Tabassum. She's a Muslim American student with a major in biomedical engineering and a minor in resistance to genocide. And out of the thousands of seniors graduating from the University of Southern California this year, she was chosen as valedictorian and, as is tradition, was asked to speak at graduation. Within days, pro-Israel groups at USC were falsely and publicly labeling Tabassum as an anti-Semite and demanding she not be allowed to speak at graduation. On Monday, the University of Southern California acquiesced to those demands. They canceled her speech. As Tabassum puts it, quote, "The university has betrayed me and caved in to a campaign of hatred," end quote. In a letter to the campus, the school's provost said, quote, "To be clear, this decision has nothing to do with freedom of speech. The issue here is how best to maintain campus security and safety, period," end quote. What exactly was the danger that Asna Tabassum posed? Tabassum has said she hadn't started thinking about what she would say in her speech before it was canceled. The only indication that Tabassum would have mentioned the war in Gaza at all came from the pro-Israel groups on campus demonizing her. But even if she did speak about the war in Gaza, how is that worthy of censorship? A university's job should be to protect students' physical safety, not to guard them from the viewpoints that make them feel uncomfortable. Yesterday, here in New York, the NYPD arrested more than 100 students at Columbia University who had been camped out on the campus's main lawn, calling for the university to divest its endowment from companies with ties to Israel because of the war in Gaza. Columbia University President Manoush Shafiq herself asked for the NYPD to intervene, citing, quote, "safety concerns." When asked to characterize the protests, NYPD Chief John Schell said that, quote, "the students that were arrested were peaceful, offered no resistance whatsoever, and were saying what they wanted to say in a peaceful manner," end quote. That's from the police. So why the crackdown? For years, celebrating the right to protest has been integral to Columbia University's brand. Lee Bollinger, who served as Columbia University's president from 2002 all the way up until last year, once told the New York Times that the administration's decision to call the police on a Vietnam War protest in 1968 was, quote, "a serious breach in the ethos of the university," end quote. In 2007, there was a similar encampment-style protest set up in the very same area of Columbia's campus. Columbia's response then was to hook up lights for the encampment and to invite the protesters to sleep in common spaces indoors to escape the cold. Columbia's campus is the site of major protests all the time, but for some reason, the school decided to crack down on this one. Why the change? Why the double standard for this particular protest? The day before Columbia University President Manoush Shafiq asked the NYPD to intervene, she was in Washington, D.C., being questioned by Republicans in Congress about claims of anti-Semitism on campus. As a group of Jewish faculty at Columbia wrote in a public letter, those Republicans questioning her were less concerned with the safety and well-being of Jewish students on campuses and more leveraging anti-Semitism in a wider effort to caricature and demonize universities as hotbeds of, quote, "woke indoctrination," end quote. Well, it appears the leverage is working. We'll talk to New York Times opinion columnist Michelle Goldberg about all of this after the break.
We have already suspended 15 students from Columbia. We have 6 on disciplinary probation. These are more disciplinary actions that have been taken probably in the last decade at Columbia.
What are the consequences in this case?
I have 5 cases at the moment who have either been either taken out of the classroom or dismissed.
And is he one of those?
He will never work at Columbia again.
Columbia beats Harvard and UPenn. Y'all have done something that they weren't able to do. You've been able to condemn anti-Semitism without using the phrase, "it depends on the context."
Columbia University President Manoush Shafiq came prepared for tough questions about her handling of anti-Semitism on campus during a Republican-led hearing this week. She talked about expelling students, and she committed to firing faculty members who had expressed sympathetic views for Hamas. And so far, she has escaped the backlash that forced the presidents of the University of Pennsylvania and Harvard to step down after a previous hearing last December. New York Times opinion columnist Michelle Goldberg explained the long-term consequences of Shafiq's actions at the university and in this week's hearing. In a piece titled, "Republicans Wanted a Crackdown on Israel's Critics," Columbia obliged. She wrote, quote, by bending over backward to be agreeable, Shafiq emerged from the four-hour grilling largely unscathed. All that's been damaged is Columbia's guarantee of academic freedom, end quote. Joining me now is Michelle Goldberg, New York Times opinion columnist. Michelle, good to have you here. This is a tough conversation because the stuff that we're talking about, the things that offend people in this conversation are offensive.
Right. I mean, I think it's tough for two reasons. One, there's been genuine incidents of both anti-Semitism and really kind of callous celebration of terrorism at Columbia, as at many other universities. And you also have, I think, a left that has created, in some sense, if not created the situation for themselves, has encouraged a really narrow reading of free speech in recent years, has said, you know, talked about emotional harm and emotional safety and that, you know, impact matters more than intent. And it was always somewhat obvious that eventually the right was going to take that and run with it.
Right.
And that's what we have here. You have basically the right saying this, or the right and also certain pro-Israel groups saying this language makes students feel unsafe.
Right.
And they have a right not to be exposed to it.
Right. And the question is that vibes are not in tune with what academic freedom needs to be in this country.
Well, especially because there's so much dispute over what anti-Semitism actually means. I mean, I think we all know, you know, that when a swastika is sprayed in a school bathroom, this is anti-Semitism, when somebody calls someone a dirty Jew. But so much of this is about what is the allowable or, you know, the what is acceptable criticism of a country that is currently in the middle of an extremely brutal war subsidized by the United States.
Tough question.
Right. Questions that you have to be able to answer.
That we as journalists have to be able to discuss, and people in academic settings have to be able to discuss. I mean, corporate America doesn't discuss this stuff. A lot of people avoid this in polite conversation. There are a few places left where we can actually deliberate this, and universities are one of them.
Right. And I think that what you're seeing, and this is somewhat unprecedented, this degree of congressional pressure on universities to shut down certain viewpoints, right? I mean, I can't think of a precedent since the House Un-American Activities
Right, since
Committee,
McCarthyism, yeah.
When you actually have, you know, college presidents being
asked
called up
about specific names of people who are professors.
Right, specific names, specific ideologies,
yeah.
You know, specific course offerings. This is a really remarkable thing, even I think if you find some of these, you know, things that some of these professors have said to be abhorrent.
Mm-hmm.
Do you really want Republicans in Congress to be deciding where the line
is? Right. And that's the issue. It's the same thing with my book club, right? There are books that are banned that may not be to your taste. They might actually be abhorrent. But the issue is whether or not the state should have a role in making these determinations. And then secondarily, and probably more importantly, given the column you wrote, whether universities should want that to happen, right? I think we are hopefully thinking that universities are places where they do undertake to guarantee the physical safety of students, the absolute physical safety of students, not how you feel. Mm-hmm. But if you are made to be uncomfortable as a student, you might be getting your money's worth at university.
Right. And again, I would go back and say that, you know, I think that the left should have defended that principle more strongly in the ensuing years, but that doesn't make it any less true. And so
right.
Now you have this situation where, and it's not just kind of, you know, quote unquote snowflake students saying that students are entitled to emotional safety. Again, it's kind of these organs of the state.
Right. Now, so what happened to the presidents of Penn and Harvard, I thought was awful the way that went down. I'm glad Manoush Shafiq gets to live to fight another day. But it was a little uncomfortable hearing her sort of say the things that those Republicans in that congressional hearing. Look, she read the room better than the other presidents did.
She read that room, but at what cost to her university, right? Because now you see these arrests at Columbia that have only redoubled the protests.
Right. And the police have said these kids were doing
nothing. This is remarkable.
Yeah.
And so you kind of see this is exactly the situation that the presidents of, I think, Harvard and Penn and MIT were trying to avoid when they refused to say that the phrase from the river to the sea violates school rules. Because Manoush Shafiq was so eager kind of not to go down that same path, she instead committed, I think, to this extreme and, you know, this extreme level of discipline with little precedent in recent years that has certainly not calmed down the situation on her campus.
You got some sense that this situation will improve anytime soon?
I mean, It doesn't look like it, right? The protests are still going on. Yep. You have large numbers of faculty who've said that they have no confidence in their administration. People are talking about boycotting graduation ceremonies. I mean, I think she's kind of, you know, she handled the hearing maybe diplomatically, yep, but she hasn't, I don't think that she's handled the tensions on her campus well at all.
Good to see you, Michelle. Thank you, as always. We appreciate the conversations with you. Michelle Goldberg is an opinion columnist for The New York Times. Tonight, well, that is our show for tonight. Before we go, last July on the Velshi Band Book Club, we featured a truly lovely children's story. It was called The Best At It by the actor Malik Pancholi. The Best At It is a book that unequivocally age-appropriate was removed from bookshelves in Florida and Texas. And not even a year later, Pancholi, who is an openly gay Indian man, is facing the burn of censorship once again. This week, a Pennsylvania school board canceled Pancholi's anti-bullying speaking engagement due to concerns about his, quote, lifestyle. I will speak again to the actor, the author, and the activist Malik Pancholi tomorrow at 10 a.m. Eastern on Velshi. Don't miss it.
Rev up your thrills this summer at Cedar Point on the all-new Top Thrill 2. Drive the sky on the world's tallest and fastest triple-launch vertical speedway. And it's your last chance to get more fun for less with our limited-time bundle for just $49.99. Get admission, parking, and all-day drinks for one low price. But you better hurry, because this limited-time bundle ends June 30th. Save now at cedarpoint.com.